please, Your Honor.
All right, and then we'll be glad to hear from you when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Lauren Campbell on behalf of the Commonwealth. The Commonwealth is asking this Court to reverse the trial court's suppression of evidence recovered after a police officer attempted to effectuate a stop on the defendant. The trial court's ruling that the stop was not justified under Terry v. Ohio is incorrect for a number of reasons. First, the trial court failed to properly apply both this court and the United States Supreme Court's jurisprudence regarding Terry stops. Second, the trial court failed to recognize that the eyewitness and anonymous tips were sufficiently corroborated to support the officer's decision to investigate. And third, the trial court was incorrect because it placed an undue emphasis on the fact that the officer did not see evidence of burglary at the hotel room. Turning to the first point, under Terry, the Fourth Amendment allows for brief investigatory stops when the officer has a reasonable, articulable suspicion that criminal activity is or may be afoot. An officer who develops such a suspicion, as in this case, may stop a person in order to identify him, to question him briefly, or to detain him briefly while attempting to obtain additional information in order to confirm or dispel the suspicion of criminal activity. Reasonable suspicion is a particularized and objective basis for suspecting the person stopped of criminal activity, and the court views the totality of the circumstances objectively from the eye of a reasonable police officer with the knowledge, training, and experience of an investigating officer.
Counsel, this is Judge Decker. Can I ask you a question about the facts?
Of course, Your Honor.
Can you outline for us the timeline in terms of what the officer knew when and how it was communicated to the officer?
Certainly. I think based on the officer's testimony, it's a little unclear exactly how she was reading and what she definitely knew. But again, it's viewed objectively versus subjectively. But the timeline suggests that at first, the dispatch indicated that it was two males that were attempting to break into this room at the hotel. It was later corrected, and she indicates that she did receive the correction that it was a male and a female in the description, which she was able to when she arrived at the scene. And she testified that she did arrive at the scene within minutes of this phone call because it was a priority burglary in progress. And when she arrived, she was able to quickly confirm or corroborate the matching descriptions of the suspects. Is there something more specific? Are you, I guess, whether or not she got... Go ahead, Judge.
Ms. Campbell, this is Judge Petty. Let me maybe expand on that a little bit. Doesn't our case law allow us to consider the information that was provided to the dispatcher in determining whether there was reasonable suspicion, even if that information, that specific information, had not been communicated to the officer on the scene?
Yes, Your Honor. That was what I was attempting to articulate by saying that it was objective versus subjective. And I think the officer did testify that she couldn't quite remember what exactly she had read or had been communicated because it sounded like...
So whether or not the officer on scene had actually read the information that was coming over her laptop, that information clearly had been communicated to dispatch and subsequently at least attempted to be communicated to the officer.
Correct, Your Honor. I would completely agree with that. And moving forward, the information was that the dispatch communicated that the male, she, the front desk clerk herself, had seen the male and appeared to be very high and intoxicated.
Now let me stop you there, because I thought all of this information was relayed by an anonymous person to the front desk clerk and then to the police department.
The front desk person, the information that was relayed to her from other hotel guests, which would be the completely anonymous, what would, could be argued the completely anonymous part, was from other hotel guests whose names were not given. However, the front desk clerk herself, who called and whose information is on the dispatch sheet, she did see the male suspect because he came to the front desk in order to try to attempt to get a key, and she communicated that she observed him and he appeared very high and intoxicated.
Can I find that in the transcript of the information relayed to the officer?
Yes.
I didn't see that. Okay.
And let me follow up on that, counsel. Wasn't it that he came to the desk and asked for the key to the very room that was involved in the potential burglary? He wanted the key to room 175, and 175 was also the room that was associated with the person presumably banging on the door.
Yes, Your Honor, and that's the room that the officer also immediately went to, the room 175. And Judge Petty, going back to your question, I believe it's on Appendix 45.
I found 65, or at least at 21 hours, 08 minutes, and 54 seconds. I found it just as we were talking. Thank you.
Oh, on the dispatch sheet as well, yes.
Ms. Campbell, Judge Humphreys, let me kind of follow up on that. It seems to me this case really is much, you know, the point of contention. I don't understand that the appellee in this case is contesting your position regarding what the law says. I guess it's how it applies to the facts of this case. And did I misread the trial court's conclusions? Because it seemed to me that what the trial court, in essence, was concluding was that upon this report of either a burglary or an attempted burglary, the officer arrives, sees no evidence of it. The trial court seemed to conclude that at that point, there's no reasonable suspicion, the analysis ends, we're done, and that there's no ability to proceed further on the part of the officer, I guess, although the trial court doesn't say this, I guess unless there's some sort of reasonable suspicion of additional criminal activity taking place. But having essentially dispelled the suspicion of criminal activity that Terry lets you investigate when the officer first arrived, seeing no evidence of a burglary, basically they're done. That was the trial court's conclusion. Would that be a fair take on my part from the way, you know, what this issue really comes down to?
Yes, Your Honor, that is how I read the opinion. It does seem, and that was kind of one of the errors I was pointing to, it does seem the trial court placed a emphasis on the fact that when the officer got to the scene, there didn't appear to be any actual breaking into the room and therefore no evidence of burglary. So even though there was other weird things going on, the officer then didn't have reasonable suspicion of the burglary and therefore couldn't investigate.
So would it come down to then whether these, as you characterize it, other weird things going on, whether those circumstances amount to reasonable suspicion that additional criminal activity is taking place?
I think so, Your Honor. I think there's kind of two things going on here. I think one is the anonymous tip, the potentially partially anonymous tips and partially eyewitness tips, and the other is just the officer arriving on the scene herself and what she saw herself of the suspicious activity of the defendant. I think both of those things on their own and the interplay between them is sufficient to provide reasonable suspicion that criminal activity was afoot.
Well, again, if that's the common law, if that's the case, then the question seems to me is whether or not the trial court was correct in concluding that these other facts and circumstances known to the officer or to agents of the Commonwealth through the dispatcher or whatever suggest that additional criminal activity or suspicion of additional criminal activity has not been dispelled, or at least that the original criminal activity has not been dispelled. So if that's the case, I mean, what are you pointing to that would support the proposition that the officer was permitted to continue her investigation at that, you know, given what she found when she arrived at the scene?
Well, I believe at the time the officer did testify that she did still suspect that he could have committed a burglary, but if we're going based on the trial court's finding that there was no evidence of burglary, then I think that when the officer got to the scene and observed what she was able to observe of the defendant's very incoherent behavior, his scene was suspicious of, I think she said, trying to pull where exactly she said what she still could have suspected him of. When she told him he was not free to leave, she suspected that he could have broken into the hotel room and committed burglary or was just trespassing. I think what the officer found at the time, a reasonable officer could not or would not have left the scene, but would need to secure the scene just briefly in order to dispel the concern that potential criminal activity and to stop the defendant from exiting in order to question him about what he was doing there and why he appeared incoherent and had white powder on his face, which matched the tip that the hotel front desk clerk had given her.
So it's not necessary to articulate any particular, in other words, white powder might suggest use of a controlled substance of one sort or another. I think there was the lack of coherence or the glassy eyes or whatever might indicate intoxication. If this is a public area, I guess that could be a crime. But I guess to what extent is an officer required to articulate specifics about what criminal activity they suspect or what objective facts would support criminal activity, I guess, or suspicion of criminal activity?
Well, yeah, an officer doesn't need to identify a precise crime she thought the defendant was committing. The officer just needs reasonable suspicion of criminal activity, not probable cause, as I think, of a particular crime, as defendant has, I think, argued. But the principal function is that the officer needs a general suspicion of criminal activity is enough, as long as the officer can articulate a reasonable basis for that suspicion. And I think what the officer has done here by those objective facts was outlaying the scene based on the tip and the scene that she observed, and that is enough to indicate that criminal activity may be afoot. Not necessarily that this particular crime has occurred, but that's what the officer needs to do. The officer needs to be able to investigate to resolve the ambiguity of what is happening and whether activity is illegal or legal, and just determine whether the defendant can go or whether there is a bigger problem. And that's why it's just a Terry stop in order to – it's a very limited encounter in order just to dispel that concern.
Okay, you're almost into your rebuttal. I just want to let you know you can keep on going.
Yes, I'll just quickly address most of the points, but I did want to argue to the court that even if this court were to find that the trial court's determination that the stop was illegal is correct, that the Commonwealth asked this court to find that the exclusionary rule does not apply because the standard is not but-for causation, but actually the purpose of the exclusionary rule is to deter police misconduct, and
counsel,
that purpose is...
Counsel, did the Commonwealth argue that below?
He argued it in reading his argument. He did argue that he had just thrown it out of his pocket, and I think that is the argument, that he threw it out of his pocket, and that's an act that was not precipitated by something the officer did, Your Honor.
Well, I think Judge Decker's question is, assuming that's the case,
mm-hmm.
Wouldn't a remand be necessary to determine whether or not, you know, the trial court made a finding about whether the fruit of the poisonous tree doctrine applied to the evidence that's discarded under those circumstances? In other words, is the record in a state where we would be able to determine factually what occurred there?
Unfortunately, I do think that the judge's opinion is not wholly clear on a number of analytical issues, but I do think that on page, I think it's...
Well, is there any finding by the trial judge of good faith on the part of the police? And doesn't that pretty much cut off that argument? Because if the police were, unless the police officer was acting in good faith, we wouldn't not suppress the evidence.
Well, Your Honor, I don't believe it's necessarily a good faith argument, but the fact that Spence's actions weren't a foreseeable consequence of the stop. The officer was trying to just stop him, and he resisted the stop and ultimately reached in his pocket and threw the drugs
right.
out.
That's so it really be an attenuation argument, whether the voluntary act of discarding the drugs attenuated any application of the exclusionary rule. Wouldn't that be the analysis? And I don't know how we would decide that without more fact-finding by the trial court, frankly.
And even so, the officer testified that she pulled his hand out of his pocket. So the fact that he was clutching the drugs when she did so, I don't see any. It's a difference without a distinction as to who actually removed the drugs.
Okay, yes, Your Honor. Well, if I have any time for rebuttal, I would like to save that now. Thank you.
All right, Ms. Michigan. Michigan, glad to hear from you when you're ready.
Yes, sir. May it please the court. Suzanne Michigan from the Virginia Beach Public Defender's Office for Mr. Spence. If I may, I'd like to maybe address several questions that you all had for the Commonwealth. And I will start with the trial court found as of the historical fact that whatever Officer Schwegler observed within the room, and I quote, seemed strange in a way that was not related to a burglary.
Ms. Michigan, let me stop you there. Let's forget about whether there was a burglary or not. Let's just focus in on the facts that were known, that were communicated to the police officers and dispatch. You've got an individual who is at the front desk and is described as very intoxicated and high, and that is from the front desk individual who's identified in the Mrs. Simi. You have information relayed that someone is banging on doors or on a door of a hotel room, certainly in a way that seems suspicious. And then the police officer arrives on the scene and sees two people who she describes as being out of it, for want of a better phrase. Why isn't that sufficient to justify the police officer to freeze the situation there and conduct further investigation?
Rihanna, respectfully, Officer Schwegler didn't corroborate or do anything to even confirm whatever information had been received, neither speaking to the front desk clerk, who only personally observed, as you just described, what she alleged my client was drunk or high and asking for a key to that room to feed his preacher who was sick.
Why is that required? I mean, why is corroboration of information required by the law? I'm not aware of any case law that supports that. I mean, it'd be nice, I suppose, and certainly would strengthen the hand with regard to developing maybe probable cause, but what, under a reasonable suspicion Terry analysis, can you point to any case law that requires the police officer to corroborate? I mean, that's the point of the investigation, is to look into it and find out what's really going on here. Either there's something criminal or there's not, and either way, let's deal with it and move on.
Your Honor, my position is this amounts to an anonymous phone call, regardless of whether or not the front desk clerk's contact information can be traced, and therefore that gives it some semblance of reliability. The alleged information regarding criminal activity is all from unknown guests.
Well, but that's not true. The front desk clerk, Mrs. Simi, who gave her name and her phone number to dispatch, said that this individual was high, very intoxicated and high. That's not an anonymous tip, is it?
That portion, Your Honor, is not. But any of the alleged criminal wrongdoing, if the crime...
Well, isn't being intoxicated and high in a public place a crime?
And, Judge, respectfully, we don't know any details about when that occurred. How are we talking hours earlier that my client approached the front desk? There's no time frame to say that criminal
isn't that corroborated when the officer looks in the room and sees one individual down on her knees, unable to communicate, and the other individual looking as described by the officer as being out of it?
I think if we allow the officer to completely speculate, Judge, but without sort of going on a hunch, that somehow this is now related to drugs or alcohol as an issue and not a trespass or burglary, those facts, and I appreciate innocent conduct can be considered, but there wasn't anything other than a woman down on her knees and my client acting odd, and odd conduct enough is simply not enough. The officer has no familiarity with these people. She's seen no drugs, no needles, the sick woman's not vomiting, nothing that indicates that this is something more than an allegation that my client at some point earlier, time frame unknown.
It's your argument, with all of the information known to the police officer, the only thing she was entitled to do is say, well, in that case, have a nice day and drive off.
No, sir. But my argument is she didn't have a right to seize my client without some other additional investigation to determine. Simply asking these people what's going on here, and I don't know if we're now turning into the community caretaker doctrine, that her concern is for the sick woman or the woman who appears to be sick.
Counsel, what we're mixing is apples and oranges here. And this comes up a lot in these Terry situations, in my experience, where, you know, we tend to forget that the Terry has the whole concept of a Terry detention, which is a seizure, is for a limited purpose to investigate. Now, that investigation should take place expeditiously, and I guess, you know, you look at the facts and circumstances, or the totality of the circumstances of each case, to determine whether or not the officer acted reasonably, which is the litmus test. And so, you know, it seems to me, if you're conceding that there's nothing wrong with the officer going to the scene and following up on the information she received, the question then becomes, at what point does it cease being reasonable for the officer to act as she did? And so she's got this information, which Judge Petty pretty aptly summarized, and she's trying to look into this by asking questions, by getting ID, by, you know, examining what she can see. And you're arguing that she has to stop at some point. And I guess what I'm not understanding is where that point is. In other words, if the point is to investigate, then the law permits an investigation, as long as it's reasonable. Now, you know, I haven't heard any argument that the time lapse here made it unreasonable. We're talking minutes rather than hours, it seems to me, if I understand the record correctly. So I'm not sure I'm understanding what your argument is, other than once she shows up and doesn't see any immediate evidence of a crime, she's got to get back in her car and drive away.
And, Your Honor, if I may, within the record, what's very clear is that the officer responds almost immediately from the call itself. Any alleged behavior, my client appearing high or intoxicated, or any alleged behavior observed by other hotel guests about the banging on the door, to that end, there's no time frame of when that was observed.
Isn't that the purpose of the investigation? I mean, the fact that it could be that it happened 2 hours before and he's no longer intoxicated, or it could be that it happened 2 minutes before and he is now intoxicated. Isn't that the purpose of the investigation, to decide which of those two alternatives is true?
To the extent of something less intrusive than seizing and handcuffing an individual without any additional information. If her sole observation was just that he was mumbling and seemed incoherent, and a woman was not responding to her question of was she okay, I think it's far more intrusive than what we have for a reasonable suspicion of criminal activity.
Well, counsel, I guess the question is, what would you have had the officer do? You told Judge Petty that he didn't have to just turn his back and walk away, so what else could the officer do other than go into the room and start asking questions?
Under the facts of this case, the other alleged suspect, in lack of way of putting it, the female is sitting outside in an SUV with a license plate, that the other women could have been asked additional questions. She certainly could have communicated more with the female. Ultimately, the female that was down on her knees refused medical help. There was no sign of any sort of drug paraphernalia in the room.
What about the white powder on the defendant's?
I think that's purely speculation or hunch, and that was subject to the officer Schregler answering. She has absolutely no basis to suspect that was drug-related. And I will point out that,
counsel, why is that not an articulable fact? That what appears to be a dry white substance on his mouth, therefore, is drug-related? Well, in context of all the other facts.
my position is this. The drugs that were recovered are heroin, and I think I did cross-examine the officer. Heroin's not typically ingested. To me, that fact is something that's thrown out by the officer, but that's not a reasonable objective basis for taking someone into custody because they have a white substance around their mouth.
But would you agree that the fact that there are innocent explanations for the white powder on his lips does not negate the fact that the officer can consider it along with his physical condition in deciding whether further investigation is necessary? This is not a beyond a reasonable doubt. This is not even a preponderance of the evidence test. This is simply a is there a possibility that that it could be drug related?
And this, my position is that is there a reasonable possibility? Not under the circumstances of this case. It's hard to argue that, and I appreciate once it's known that 97 hits of heroin are recovered from my client. However, there was nothing within that hotel that was drug related other than the items discarded by my client.
But counsel, we don't look beyond the time of the seizure to determine, you know, hindsight is 20/20 type concept. The law is that we look to the facts prior to the seizure, and the facts prior to the seizure include the white powder around the mouth, the odd behavior, the sick woman in the room. All of that goes to the analysis, not the end result.
And Judge, I appreciate that. I wanted to make sure that as I argue that in good faith, I know that after the fact, yes. But I am saying at the time of what the officer observed, the only information that she had firsthand viewed by the clerk was that my client appeared high and intoxicated. There was no investigation into that whatsoever. The reliability of the front desk clerk, when that behavior was observed, whether or not the front desk clerk had seen my client's normal behavior, things of that nature. This goes back to the trial court's finding of fact. Although the situation in the room appeared strange, and that was the trial court's word, did it appear strange in essence in showing that my client was engaged or was about to be engaged in criminal activity? My suggestion is, in order to go violate the Fourth Amendment and affect a seizure, the officer didn't have articulable facts that my client was engaged in criminal activity. Did she have a hunch? Did she have suspicions, perhaps, that this was drug-related, things of that nature? Perhaps she did. That, I guess, blurs with subjective versus objective. And when we go to this sort of good faith basis of what she actually read from her KDT laptop, what she testified to was her investigation was for the burglary and trespass. She was not investigating drug-related crimes.
Counsel, Judge Humphreys again. Let me follow up on what you just said and get it clear in my mind. Do I gather correctly that you're not saying that there's anything wrong with the officer responding to this 911 call and showing up at the scene? It's just that at some point the investigation hadn't developed anything and they needed a lead. Is that your basic position?
To some extent, Your Honor. My argument is there had to be more sufficient reliability or indicia of reliability to any allegation there if, in fact, we're now focusing solely on the fact that my client was intoxicated and high. With all of the other bodies of cases, there is something done to corroborate that by officers, be it the nature of the area being a high-crime area or a drug area or...
I'm going to have to do this the hard way. You don't have any problem, do you, with the officer responding to the 911 call in the first place?
The actual response, no, sir. The entry into the hotel room and the seizure of my client, yes, sir.
So so we get the officer to the hotel room. The door is standing wide open, and the officer has this information about the attempted burglary or whatever, and sees the individuals. At that moment, you still don't have any problem, do you?
I do have a problem seizing the individuals based on the burglary information. Yes,
all right,
sir.
I'm not at that point yet. So,
okay.
So the officer, you don't have any difficulty with the officer being at least at the door of the room. Now, the officer sees what she sees, and I'm not going to rehash all of that. And here I gather is where where you have a problem is that when your client attempted to leave, he should have been permitted to leave rather than seized and handcuffed. Is that the bottom line?
Yes, sir.
So it's at that moment, I guess, as Judge Decker alluded to this, it's at that moment we measure what did the officer know, what was the officer investigating, whether the officer's actions were reasonable under the totality of the circumstances. Would you agree that that's the analysis here?
Yes, sir.
Okay. Thank you. That clarifies my time.
Can I just clarify one fact? It appeared to me that you and the Commonwealth's attorney stipulated that this was a recorded 911 call. Am I correct on that?
Yes, sir.
Okay, thank you.
And if I may, I wanted to point out where I see the case law as distinguishable. I'm trying to remember exactly if it's the Fitchett case or not, but the Commonwealth attorney cited an unpublished decision. It was the Daly case, in which the officer or trooper stopped a vehicle for a 2-foot-long crack. The parties later stipulated that that would have passed state inspection. The court found that was still reasonable on articulate suspicion that the appellant in that case was violating the law. What we have here is just pure conjecture. Was my client violating the law? If my client, based on the trial court's finding, was not committing any criminal activity related to a burglary or trespass, what is the other objective information that this officer had to seize my client for, again, a suspicion of his involvement in criminal activity? If this court is now suggesting, because of the basis of the clerk at some point saying my client was high or intoxicated, there's absolutely no corroborating information even observed by Officer Shagler other than odd conduct. And odd conduct is never enough to seize someone under that.
I think the problem I'm having, counsel, maybe you can persuade me, the problem I'm having is, and the reason I asked the series of questions I did is, if you have no problem with the officer being on the scene at the doorway, and it's only after that, the officer's there to investigate. That's the purpose of a Terry stop. Now, while that investigation is proceeding, and as long as it isn't unreasonable in length or in the manner in which it's being conducted, the law permits a detention. The law permits your brief seizure during the course of the investigation. So if the investigation is proceeding and it's reasonable for the officer to continue to investigate, to get to the bottom of whatever is going on, then it seems to me you're not allowed to leave under the law. You just can't walk away from a valid Terry stop. And so, the trial judge, I understand the trial court's ruling was that the investigation basically should have ended at that point, and that's de novo review on our part, I guess. But I'm just trying to make this as narrow as possible to understand the point in time when we're measuring all this is when your client tried to walk out the door and got handcuffed for his trouble and the drugs were then subsequently discovered.
Judge Humphreys, if I may, an analogy, because obviously I live at Virginia Beach. If there was an allegation of a concert down at the oceanfront that there was a fight and officers respond and at some point whoever's telephoned it in said, and I think everybody's drunk down there, would it be acceptable for the officers to show up at that concert to not see any evidence whatsoever of a physical fight, but see people who appeared to be intoxicated, and then handcuff and arrest all of the concert goers without any independent observation, objective or otherwise, to say criminal conduct is being committed or about to be committed by the other concert goers? My point is that officers should be required to do something far less intrusive than to seize someone simply to try to maintain status quo. To the extent that I don't believe at a concert we would be allowing police to arrest and handcuff every other concert goer there just in case they could provide any information. I don't think that's the way, in my opinion, and I put to the court that the law suggests that we're allowed to do as officers. and that citizens are subject to that kind of intrusive behavior simply because the scene appears suspicious in some way, perhaps entirely unrelated to my client.
You know, in Terry v. Ohio, the suspected criminal activity was the fact that Mr. Terry and his friend Mr. Chilton were walking back and forth in front of a store window several times, and that's all. And the Supreme Court said, in the officer's experience and in watching him, he thought they might be casing the place for a robbery, and therefore that was a reasonable suspicion to investigate further.
And respectfully, Your Honor, what evidence that we have that Officer Schwegler believed in her experience that my client must have been intoxicated, must have been consuming or dabbling in drugs or what have you, simply because he had a white powder on his mouth and he was acting incoherently. This is a woman who's never met my client before, can make no objective basis about my client's normal mannerisms, normal demeanor, what have you. And yet, we're suggesting that she could place my client in handcuffs and seize him to, again, determine what criminal activity might possibly be committed by my client. Counsel,
your time is up, Ms. Egan, but you can wrap it up very quickly if you would.
Yes, sir. There were no more questions then. My position is this. I did want to make one last comment that the exclusionary rule was never raised or even addressed with the trial court. But my position is this. The officer is certainly justified as a peace officer to respond to these type of calls. But I think what is required are some objective facts that citizens are committing or about to commit criminal conduct, criminal activity, or illegal activity. Everything that appears to be in this situation when Officer Schwegler handcuffed and seized my client is simply conjecture or speculation. It was not a reasonable basis to believe that he was committing any type of criminal conduct related to a burglary, related to drug use, or anything of that nature. So I ask the court to uphold the trial court's decision, please.
Thank you, Ms. Besegan. Ms. Campbell?
Briefly, Your Honor, just in response to the defendant's analogy, the Commonwealth would contend that if officers were responding to a possible fight and people being drunk in public, they could question drunk people. No, they couldn't arrest them, but that's exactly what we have here. The officer was simply trying to investigate the situation and told the defendant he needed to stay so that she could investigate what was going on, and no, the officer doesn't need to be familiar with his normal mannerisms. That's exactly why she needs to investigate, to see why he appears incoherent, what's going on. And I am not aware of anything that in the TIP case law that says corroboration means that the officer needs to talk to these witnesses. The officer was able to corroborate the information by seeing exactly what the TIP suggested, that this person was at this room matching this description, appearing incoherent, possibly intoxicated, and possibly had drugs on his mouth. I think the totality of the circumstances and the facts, viewed objectively, a reasonable police officer would have attempted to stop the defendant from exiting the hotel and leaving the scene in order to preserve and investigate what was going on. And it was a Terry stop is not so intrusive, and therefore the Commonwealth would ask that this court reverse the trial court suppression of the evidence. And if there's no further questions, thank you for your time.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Campbell. Ms. Besegan, the court will wish you both a happy new year again and adjourn to conference.